Welcome everyone to the House of Wisdom podcast, where we interview academic influencers about their research and how it can shape the world. I am Deepak Mawar, an academic.
And I'm Carl Lewis, also an academic.
Happy New Year to everyone. Carl, how was your holiday break? A nice one?
It was really good. I took our advice from the last time we had a conversation before holiday, and I genuinely took a break. I didn't look at anything work-related at all for weeks, and I genuinely feel rested. I'm excited about the start of this year for the first time in a while, to be honest. The other time has just been me going, oh God, do I have enough energy? Yeah, let's go. Now I'm like, no, I'm ready. You, how was your holiday break?
It was great. And then January came and then I had to do loads of marking.
Oh, no.
So yeah, marking is a killer.
Where did your marking start?
Straight away.
What, I mean, 1st of January?
Yeah, well, I had to start marking before the holiday break started. And I went, and I, again, did the same thing as you, took our advice from the previous episode. I was like, nope, not going to do it. I will start January 2nd. And then started then. Students, you will not find out how you've done. I'm staying silent and neutral about it. So yeah, that was nice. But no, I just want to mention how much I really enjoyed the last OWL episode. I think it was something that I'm really happy we did. We could have easily just been like, oh, we couldn't find someone and just left it at that. But actually to talk about something that we're quite passionate about, I think is a really good thing. And I'm really happy it's out there for people to hear. And when they do listen to it, they'll be like, okay, maybe I should take that in. So I'm really glad that we've done that. And it's our way of just releasing or expressing how we feel about the academic community, which is something we want to address and we want to talk about in the future too.
Yeah, I kind of want to put it as a reminder in my calendar to listen to it before every holiday break, just to remind myself, no, you should. Maybe relax.
Yeah, exactly. I'm doing this right now in the hotel room in Bogota, which has been quite cool. Nice
little
place. Fruit is delicious. This is something we've discussed before we started recording. Ruined pineapple for me forever because I will never have pineapple as fresh as I have had in Ecuador. It was just... So I remember we were driving by to go to like one of the beaches, and we just stopped off the side of the road, and there was a pineapple store, and behind the pineapple store was a field of pineapples. It was like the freshest pineapple you'll ever have. It was 50 cent, big tub, and it was so good.
You know what? This is going to sound silly. So I had some of the most delicious orange juice in a while in London. Now, I know this isn't going to compare to whatever you're experiencing, but for some reason, and my partner will attest this as well, oranges are better in the UK right now than they are in the Netherlands. And this makes not that much sense either, because I know those oranges aren't coming from the UK. So I want to know where they're coming from. I assume Spain.
Was it nice though to go back to London?
No, it was really good. It was really good to see family. The pace of London is always a surprise. Every time I go, I forget people on a different level of speed when you're in London, right? Yeah. Everyone's got something to do and quickly. But London's still good. London's still amazing. The people are still lovely. Yeah, I mean, I miss it often. Do you miss London?
No.
Oh, but important point. While I was there, plenty of strikes, right? So we had to get a car because, train strikes. As we were planning a holiday. I was like, all right, we'll get a train down to, you know, where my mother lives, down the south of the UK. And the internet said, no, you shall not take trains anywhere. There are strikes. And there is where I felt, you know, a lot of real life practical happenings which relate to what we're going to be discussing today with Professor Mate.
Absolutely. It's a very pertinent time to be talking about the book that we're discussing in today's episode. And another way I've kind of experienced this pushback and this idea of gathering together and protesting and pushing back against kind of the status quo is by watching a show that's been out recently that I got you to watch and I encouraged you profusely to watch, which is the show Andor. The more and more I've thought about it, the more and more I feel like it's the best show I watched last year. It's such an incredible insight into what it feels like to rebel and why you would rebel against the status quo and what people are like when they are oppressors. So I talked to you a few months back about how there was a YouTube video talking about how Andor really resonates quite well with Hannah Arendt's philosophy of the banality of evil. And I really see it quite heavily when I look at Andor and the way in which a lot of the Imperial troops, the Imperial officers, kind of detach themselves from the humanity of it, the reality of oppression and oppressing people, and are almost just doing a job and are looking at, okay, how can I get on top of that food chain? How can I actually work my way up that promotional ladder and become the best officer there? And having such a lack of empathy and humanity about how these people are treated. And I think for a Star Wars show, for a sci-fi fantasy show to do that, I think it's phenomenal.
I think the thing is that it resonates. It's a timely show. I mean, even if it is about, it's a fictional story with fictional characters, the topics are so timely. The characters are so recognizable. Yeah, no, it's a great recommendation, which we're not getting paid for. Important to say, we are not getting paid.
Yes. Oh, imagine that. That'd be great. That'd be amazing.
Hey. Who knows?
Definitely recommend it. And yeah, like I say, the reason we brought it up is because it kind of resonates really well with today's topic about austerity, its lineage, its origins, and how it came about. And it is a result of the working class attempting to emancipate themselves, attempting to actually become a collective force to demand better conditions. So I think it was just a relevant time to talk about Andor, and also I just loved it so much. So anytime I come to discuss it is a good one. But yeah, I thought definitely worth talking about, and I think it segues really well into today's topic and into today's guest.
In this episode, we talked to Professor Clara Matei, a professor in the Economics Department of the New School for Social Research, to explore her latest book, The Capital Order: How Economists Invented Austerity and Paved the Way to Fascism. In this book, Professor Matei traces modern austerity to its origins in interwar Britain and Italy, revealing how the threat of working class power in the years after World War I animated a set of top-down economic policies that elevated owners, smothered workers, and imposed a rigid economic hierarchy across their societies.
Welcome, Professor Matei. Thank you so much for joining us today.
It's a real pleasure to be here.
So we're going to be essentially engaging with this concept of austerity, and we're going to be hearing more about your research, especially building from your book, The Capital Order: How Economists Invented Austerity and Paved the Way to Fascism. But could you tell us a little bit about how you got into this topic?
So I have a background in philosophy. I have my MA and BA and MA in philosophy. And then I was very interested in figuring out how the world worked. And this is how I got into a PhD in economics that then ended up being very different from what I had expected in terms of understanding how our economic system actually functions, as it was mostly about abstractions that had very little to do with actual current economic issues. So I struggled throughout the PhD, and then I was wondering how could I make sense of my work as a researcher and finding out something that could be, in fact, be meaningful to me. And that's when I was in Italy doing my PhD in Italy. We were under huge austerity attacks from the Mario Monti era of post 2009 sovereign debt crisis. And that's when I came across an article that was discussing fascist economic policies in the 1920s. And it's when I realized the immense parallelism and the astonishing parallelism that had, though until that moment, had been little discussed. So that's what got me into exploring this specific topic. And that's why the intention of the Capital Order is to propose also a methodology that really breaks with the usual boundaries. Political economy, a work in historical political economy, requires to go beyond the history of economic thought, beyond methodology, beyond economic theory, and put pieces together that really can help explain why the economy is the way it is to the present day.
Yeah, so for me, it's really interesting to hear that there are so many people that end up starting in a different field and moving into this discipline. So there's obviously clearly an allure there and something very stimulating, very engaging to engage with. And to just start off, I found the book really, really stimulating and engaged with it so well. And going through it, I just had so many notes because it was just so interesting and so topical, especially what's going on. But myself and Carl being from the UK, we can really see such an important discussion being had in this book. So my first question is, please tell us about your book. You know, what is it about? Where is it taking us? And why is it such an important piece?
The book is very ambitious in its intention to analyze why austerity is so persistent in shaping our lives. The claim is that austerity is not the outcome of the neoliberal epoch, but has a much longer and structural history and is actually quite fundamental to how capitalism functions. So the idea is that the eye of the historian can really help look critically at what goes on currently. And this is why looking at the origins of austerity can really have us understand certain elements that are key to its logic that otherwise can really end up being less clear and less vivid. And I think what you just mentioned is very important is how timely the connection between austerity acting as a countervailing mechanism to block and impede social uprisings, demand for social change is quite obvious at present. In fact, right now, we are seeing enormous amount of labor unrest in the UK for certain, also in the United States. There is a great labor action tracker from Cornell University that tells you real time all of the strikes that are going on in the United States that's present. And what is clear is that we are in a moment in which there is a fundamental challenge to what I call the capital order, which is the title of the book, The Capital Order. Capital order meaning capital as the fundamental social relation that organizes our society and that allows for capitalist growth and for capitalist accumulation to even happen, right? And this social relation is the fact that we are all accepting as citizens under capitalist economies to sell our labor power in return for a wage, which is usually a very low wage and in very precarious conditions. So now it is the moment in which, as I tell the story about what happens after the First World War, but it's clear that also today, inflation is not just an economic issue, is mostly a political issue. Why? Because it triggers the breakdown of the consensus by which our system is, in fact, very efficient in delivering what it promises. With inflation, there is more social unrest. People go to the streets. There are many more picket lines and much more protests. And the reaction of the elite in this current moment is austerity. Austerity in the form of monetary deflation, so interest rate hikes that are happening by now, but almost 6 months of interest rate hikes from the Fed, the Bank of England, the ECB, coupled with very harsh fiscal rigor. We know that the book came out on November 17th, which was exactly the day in which the Chancellor of the Exchequer in Britain, Hunt, declared the necessity to cut around 55 billion fundamentally in social expenditures, given that he was not willing to cut at all in the military sector. So the story that I tell, which is about the moment exactly 100 years ago in 1919-1920 after the Great War, is a story about how austerity acts as a tool, a mechanism of reaction to calls for social change. And I think this is something that recurs historically throughout the 20th and 21st century. We've seen it a lot in the 70s. Of course, again, the winter of discontent, the major labor unrest in the UK, for example, just to mention one example, which was then, of course, blocked by the Thatcherite austerity. And finally, right now, we're seeing this again. So I do think that the eyes of the historian are very helpful to kind of look clearer and really have already in one's imagination what are the countervailing mechanisms to protect capitalism from any call of alternatives.
So I find it really fascinating that, okay, you defined for us the capitalist order as a fundamental social relationship. And I remember this in your book when you mentioned, well, capitalism is a relation, right? And I think this comes through a lot when you talk about actors, individuals, and where, of course, those individuals are placed in social ordering. Could you give us a definition, a bit like you did for the capitalist order, of austerity, though? Well, I mean, so if someone switches on the news and sees, well, you know, we have governments thinking about austerity measures and whatnot, and they've never heard of the word austerity before, how would we see that in play on a day-to-day basis? What can we expect when we hear about austerity measures, and from who? Because I think that's what you really push home. It's coming from somewhere, and potentially not from the objective market as we would perhaps imagine.
Yes, thank you. Very important to define. So as with capital, capital being a social relation and not a fact, not a given, not something that we can just accept as a necessity. This is also true about austerity. Austerity is a political project, which is, of course, cloaked as a technical mechanisms in the hands of the experts. But austerity is a deeply political project, which is at once theory and policy. Theory that justifies a specific set of policies. And in The Capital Order, my book, I define it as a trinity. So austerity fundamentally as being about fiscal austerity, monetary austerity, and industrial austerity. And the three act in unison and reinforce one another. So let's just, so that everyone is on the same page. When we talk about fiscal austerity, we're talking about where the state decides to spend and where the state decides to take its revenue from. So it's not just about cutting expenditures in general. It's about cutting specific types of expenditures. It's about cutting the welfare expenditures, especially public education, healthcare, housing, unemployment benefits, and so on. So while the state may decide to increase, for example, its military expenditure, something that all states are doing right now, they are simultaneously cutting on the resources that go to the majority. So with fiscal austerity, what is happening is that you're taking away resources from the majority and using it to pay back, for example, the debt, which is the money that is pocketed by a very small minority, the savers, investors. So this is where the state spends. Now, the state, where does the state take the money from? And the idea of fiscal austerity is that you take the money through regressive mechanisms, regressive taxation, meaning that ultimately it's the majority of the working people who contribute more to the revenue of the state with respect to the elites. This is, for example, the idea of increasing consumption taxes, which hits us all in the same way, notwithstanding our income. It's also the case of abolishing corporate taxes, right? Something that, for example, the Trump administration did, and it lowered it from 2017. In the United States, they were 35%, the corporate taxes. Now they're 21%. It's the same as abolishing any form of capital levy. Anyway, the idea that you are taking in money from the majority rather than from the saving, investing minority. This is fiscal austerity. Then we have monetary austerity, which is much more straightforward. It's the policy of dear money. So the idea that you are increasing the cost of lending money, or better, of borrowing money, so that interest rates go up. So it's more expensive to borrow, and creditors once more get rewarded because they get more money out of the money they lend. And then we have finally industrial austerity, which is all about what happens at the level of the labor market. Industrial austerity is fundamentally about, first of all, privatization, which of course increases the market dependence of all of us because it throws us in a situation by which we need to participate in market competition. And this has an effect of lowering wages usually because you have to, in fact, kind of accept the law of supply and demand in the labor market. And then it's about direct attacks on unions. It's about labor deregulation, something that we've seen over and over again, making labor more precarious. And fundamentally abolishing all the labor rights that slowly in some countries, certain unions have in fact achieved. So this trinity, fiscal, monetary, industrial, work together in order to structurally shift resources from the many to the few. And this is very important because ultimately, when we hear experts give us the rhetoric of balancing the budget and curbing inflation, ultimately, they're working for a deeper end, which is the end of making sure that capital as a social relation by which we are accepting to participate in a social order made of wage relations and private property of the means of production is ultimately the only way forward. And we have no option but to accept unless we want to, you know, get the margins of society or not have enough to survive.
I think it's so important and so essential that we do break down austerity and what it is, because I think there's always this idea that austerity is this idea of being more responsible for the wider public and for the wider society. But then moving away from that, so I'm going to put my international lawyer hat on and look back at this time period in the 1920s. And as an international lawyer, we look at this period as actually quite an optimistic time. There's a lot of development with the League of Nations. There's a lot of states now pushing forward to try to renunciate war. And all these initiatives to actually maintain the peace. But reading your book on an economic perspective, it's completely different. It seems like a far more bleak outlook and a far more desperate era and period. And what I thought was actually the two disciplines, one thing that is quite similar is actually desperation. Desperation with the international law was actually to then establish the League of Nations, to have all these instruments come into play. But then desperation in an economic sense was austerity. And how much of that rings true in terms of desperation being a key reason for why austerity really became such a key feature following the 1920s and following World War One?
That's a very nice way of putting it. So I think the first part of the Capital Order is all about reconstructing the red years following the First World War. So 1918, 1920, as years that for some were years of desperation, but I would say that for many others, they were years of expectations for a better world to come. The sacrifice of the First World War that I describe in my book, all of the ways in which the state had even further exploited its population in order to actually confront the war necessities, all bureaucrats and leaders of government were then having to promise a land fit for heroes, right? In the words of Lloyd George. So a world that would be, in fact, different economically. No one was going to accept the idea that capitalism, laissez-faire capitalism, was just going to start on a fresh footing. Everyone thought it was actually close to an end. So I have many quotes in the book from actually primary sources in which it is clear that nobody thought that there were capitalism was going to survive one extra day. This is, for example, Willie Gallacher, the British shop steward leader. "The order of industry, which previous to the war seemed destined to last forever, is now tottering in every country of the world." And this is something that not just the radical workers were thinking, but quite widespread if you read any bourgeois newspaper of the time. So moments of desperation for some, hope for others. And the idea of the book is to reconstruct all the spectrum of possibilities for structural change that were occurring after the First World War. Years that we have forgotten because after austerity took over, we came to normalize our current situation, but after the First World War, 1919, 1920, were years of great social experiments towards a different basis to organize society. So the idea that it was no longer going to be about production for profit, but production for use. It was no longer going to be about commodified labor, but actually emancipated labor. So the big demand for economic democracy based on self-governance of industry and of even of the occupation of land by the peasants in the countryside. So a whole bunch of from more reformist to more radical alternatives to laissez-faire capitalism. It is here that, in fact, the League of Nations also plays a role to reimpose the commitment to the status quo ante, in the sense that the experts actually reunited. They were called by the League of Nations in 1920 at Brussels, and then in 1922 in Genoa, to get together with economic experts as well. So all sorts of experts. Everyone was called to participate except for representatives of labor. So these very technocratic, the emergence of global technocracy to try to really block these alternatives to capitalism that were emerging. So the 1920s then did become years of desperation for the majority once austerity hit, and it hit hard, both through slashes of public social expenditures. So all of the nascent welfare system that was actually born right in those years. In 1918, we had the first institutions of the modern welfare state. Those were all eliminated by austerity in the 1920s. But austerity also fundamentally repressed wages, and with dear money, of course, increased unemployment. And of course, the result of unemployment, as someone like Michael Kalecki very well tells us, is that through increasing the unemployment rates, the result is the structural disciplining of the population into accepting their wage conditions. So this is something I show quite clearly in chapter 9 of The Capital Order, is the immediate coercive effect of austerity in foreclosing all of these potential for social changes. How? Well, once unemployment soared through this self-induced recession, through this monetary austerity of increasing interest rates. So increase of interest rates cooled down the economy quite quickly, especially in Britain. And this had as a result that of increasing the unemployment rate, which brought immediately strikes to an end and all these labor mobilization. And at that point, the system was once more safe in the saddle. I would like to conclude by citing a line of G.D.H. Cole. G.D.H. Cole was a Guild socialist who was very active as proposing these alternatives made of guilds in Britain, which were actually very successful until 1921 when the austerity-induced recession kicked in. And Cole observes what happens throughout the 1920s once austerity is peaking. And he says, the big working class offensive had been successfully stalled off. And British capitalism, though threatened with economic adversity, felt itself once more safely in the saddle and well able to cope both industrially and politically with any attempt that might still be made from the labor side to unseat it. So here we see how the desperation of the majority that took the form of mass unemployment was really, in a way, a small cost for the gain of the elite, which was the gain of preserving capital as the way to organize society.
We've discussed how austerity had, within it, this principle excluding the general public. This feature, the exclusion of the general public, and you mentioned specific sectors of the public too, where do you see this happening now potentially? Right? Yeah. And do you have any examples that you'd like to share with us?
Definitely. So the Capital Order shows how a key feature of austerity is the attempt to depoliticize the economic domain, or better, the better word is probably de-democratize the economic domain. So the idea that part of how you preserve the system is that you make austerity into a non-choice, given that it is actually a choice taken by the expert elite that actually runs the economic machine without any disruption by the general public. So this is once more something that needs to be constructed institutionally. A clear example is the independent central bank. Independent central bank that, again, is something that we take for granted, but something that had to be constructed historically. And this actually took place in the 1920s, the years that I studied. In a moment in which, in fact, the general public was asking for a greater say in how to manage the economy. And actually, the Labour Party, for example, in Great Britain, was demanding the nationalization of the Bank of England. It is in this moment that more than ever, experts had to really justify and impose central bank independence. And Ralph Hawtrey, who's one of my protagonists, put it very clearly, the central bank should be free to never explain, never regret, never apologize. So the understanding that, this is a quote, again, taken from the archives, this book is not my invention, it's made up of primary sources, all archival material. And this idea of independent central bank in those years was actually diffused all over the globe. So the experts I study, when the treasury officials went and imposed it in Brazil, for example, in the late 1920s, in India in 1932. So again, central bank independence is something that was constructed in a specific moment in which there was a larger demand for economic democracy. And this is something that holds true today. The ECB is one of the most independent central banks of the world. And its status is explicitly taken in order to avoid any mingling with economic decisions from the part of the political entities. So I'm just looking at a part of the statute of the ECB. So since the Maastricht Treaty, the ECB retains formal independence from elected officials so as to operate without prejudice, this is from quotes from its statute, in favor of price stability, its primary mandate. This constitution also forbids European Council representatives from being part of the ECB's council. It also explicitly forbids the ECB board to receive any instruction from either community or national political institutions. So this political independence, which is accompanied by economic independence in the ECB, which means that it has no obligation to finance the member nations' public deficits, thus heavily restricting expansionary fiscal policy within its states. So this is one example of how you de-democratize the economic domain, is by preserving the decision-making authority of how to run monetary policy, which is key to how our economy works, in the hands of these unelected bureaucrats. And this, I think, is very strong. So the comparative example I give in the book, which is Britain in 1920s, compared with Italy in the 1920s, is exactly to show how what went on in the cradle of parliamentary democracy through the tweaking of these macroeconomic dials that were in the hands of these experts in these independent institutions. So what was happening in England through the Bank of England and the Treasury was very similar to what was happening in other places, like in Italy, under a fascist regime, in which, of course, you didn't need an independent central bank, because at that point, the de-democratization process of the economic realm was explicitly done through an authoritarian government. So the provocative claim of the book is that if you put side by side the cases of parliamentary Britain in the 1920s and its heavy austerity dosage through these independent institutions, it's not very different from what was happening in the 1920s under Benito's Mussolini's fascism. And this is the case throughout. So what we see is that cases of authoritarian governments who are actually applauded by the liberal elite because it is able to protect the correct economic decisions of austerity is something that we see throughout the 20th and 21st century. You can just think about the case of Pinochet's Chile in the 70s, the case of Boris Yeltsin's authoritarian turn in the 1990s in the ex-Soviet Union, and so forth. So in all these cases, what you see is that de-democratization through taking away decision-making authority from the population can be done in different ways. And one other example I think that is very obvious for us today is also, for example, that in many constitutions, for example, in the Italian constitution, this was passed just recently, we have the balanced budget that is now inserted within the constitution. So another way to protect the capital order and make sure that austerity is done as a technical necessity and no longer the choice is to put the necessity of balancing the budget inside the constitution. And this is the recent reform. And of course, the monetary union itself is a way to impose austerity, the idea that we are all in the Eurozone and we no state can actually deal with its monetary policies anymore. That's another clear example. And this, I would like to say, is not something that I'm saying and economists themselves, mainstream economists themselves don't know. Actually, if you read the works of mainstream political economists such as Alberto Alesina and other economists who have been big supporters of austerity in the last 10 years, they explicitly claim that democracies, representative democracies, are less efficient and more inflation prone. So the fact is that if you want efficiency, this has to go with lesser degrees of democracy. And this is something that if you read mainstream political economy once more, is something that is, there's a whole literature of public choice that is explicitly saying that there is a trade-off between economic efficiency and democratic participation.
So I think when you do start learning more about austerity and how effective it has been in perhaps prioritizing the wealthier parts of society, one can get quite bleak and pessimistic about the whole situation and about how to deal with this problem. But I think from your book, actually, there was one line that I really liked that I think shows where there is actually quite a lot of hope there. And I kind of just, in my notes, kind of summarize in terms of keeping citizens occupied with labor so that it prevents an enfranchisement of citizens for better social and political and economic conditions. And from that, I thought that idea of actually preventing enfranchisement of citizens shows that austerity is almost like a tool of fear. Like it is quite fearful of what sort of social, economic, political movements that can take place from the wider parts of society and from the wider corners of society. And would you perhaps say that austerity is the fear of the wealthy elites, and perhaps there is that hope, that there is that mobilization that you can see that can take place? And I think a good example of that is right now in the UK, there's a lot of strikes taking place. You are seeing a lot of unions actually being quite politically active and doing a really good job of actually tackling austerity policies that are in place in the UK. So my sense of hope is actually that the fact that austerity is a response to that fear of actually seeing enfranchised citizens.
Absolutely. I think this is exactly the spirit in which I wrote this book. The hope rests in the fact that if you have a historical lens that shows you how our current system is not a natural given, and that actually austerity is makes sense as a policy if you see it as an instrument to protect what they want us to think is in fact unavoidable, this gives us a lot of hope. And I think in moments like today, in which the association is so obvious, that it's very interesting to see how, in terms of time sequence, we really see the whole social mobilization coming out of inflationary pressures and the immediate reaction of the wealthy elite through hardcore austerity, which again might sound irrational economically, but it really isn't, because once more, the fact that they are inducing a recession and they know it makes a lot of sense if you see how this will in fact tie the hands of organized labor through the greater unemployment rate. And this is why experts are telling us that in order to prevent social mobility, we need to resolve the problem of the labor market being too tight, right? Right now, we're in a moment, the labor market is too tight. So the bargaining power is favorable to the people. There's a lot of unions emerging, especially in the United States, in previously non-unionized sectors, such as in the third sector, right? In the restaurants and retail sectors, etc. So in this sense, I think that understanding how austerity reacts to these episodes of social change really can have us understand clearly how there is a possibility of deconstructing austerity as a necessity and actually revealing its true essence as an instrument of class struggle. And at that point, this can empower the movement towards change in better understanding its enemy, and thus acting in a way preemptively in order to not get stuck in the coercive results of austerity.
coming to the end of our episode now, we're going to ask you a question that we ask all of our guests. And it's simply this. If you were in the House of Wisdom, imagine it was a real place, and you had the opportunity to invite someone to either draft a speech with you to urge states to discuss the adoption of austerity policies, or indeed, as you just said, to reveal the effects of austerity policies on this idea of class struggle, the coercive nature of austerity, who would you invite, past or present, to help you with this?
I would invite the favorite character of my book, which is Antonio Gramsci, who I've already mentioned in this episode, because Antonio Gramsci really is someone who understands how, in order to act differently, you got to think differently, but you can only really think differently if you're already in the process of acting. And in this sense, I think it is very important for us as academics to be in constant touch with real life struggles and not be in the ivory tower. So Gramsci really debunked not only bourgeois institutions through the councils, but also the bourgeois approach to knowledge, which was an approach to knowledge that tried to not only naturalize the current system, but also defeat the agency of the working classes, right? So he puts back at the center stage the agency of the working classes, but realizes that this agency is required, requires a unity of intents and a collaborative effort that comes from also from professors who, again, have to participate themselves in the front line. So I think chapter four of The Capital Order for me is the most inspiring, in the sense that I really go through how theoretically Gramsci is proposing a radical but very timely alternative to austerity and to capitalism in general, which is not the alternative that we have in mind when we think of the Soviet Union and the dictatorship from above, the statist alternative. It was the alternative of workers' democracy coming from below that I think in a lot of places in the world is still experimented with, starting from the council movement in Chile that is pretty strong in these moments, and other episodes that, of course, the mainstream media hides from us constantly. So this is a thing. Either you participate in the struggle or you don't see the struggle happening. Thus, you end up thinking that we're stuck in this world forever. But actually, there's a lot of people out there who are struggling daily to change our society. And so it's important for us academics to try to like really find these places of alternative practices that are happening and give voice to them and participate.
Antonio Gramsci would definitely be more than welcome to join us in the House of Wisdom. I definitely like that choice. So with that, Professor Matei, thank you very much for your time. We really enjoyed having you on the podcast.
Thank you so much. It was really a pleasure.
So that was the episode with Professor Clara Matei, or her interview rather. And first thing I want to say is I really enjoyed reading this book. I found it incredibly stimulating, really provocative, and it just gripped me straight away in terms of talking about economics, especially both you and I are not economists.
Nope.
And our expertise is quite minimal, let's say, when it comes to economics. I found it really accessible in terms of how she discussed it. Yes, perhaps there is quite a philosophical and political background to it, but regardless, it was a book that I found amazingly easy to read and understand. And that's one of the reasons why I actually do recommend the book to anyone who's interested about what austerity is and realizing or finding out exactly what this term is, actually.
Yeah, I was especially taken by this this phrase that Professor Matei was telling us, you know, capitalism as social relations. I never thought about it that way, right? I mean, it seems so obvious as soon as she said it. Mm-hmm. And as soon as you read it, you're like, yeah, of course. I don't know, throughout the whole book, there's this kind of reminder. Don't think of the capitalist order as this kind of objective fact that we have to live by.
Yeah. I also quite like the idea that austerity is a central feature of modern day capitalism too. So it's not some kind of surprise occurrence. It's actually almost like part of the modus operandi of a capitalist society or of a capitalist system. So there is this idea of actually increasing the pressure on the working class to then be, as she said, disenfranchised or not to become enfranchised, to then have this political movement to then look for an alternative approach to the political and economic system. So I find that really interesting in terms of it is part and parcel of it. It's not something that is a random or extraordinary phenomenon. It is exactly how a capitalist system operates. I can't remember exactly if I did mention in the interview, but I remember talking to my wife about this, about the idea of austerity. And amazing scientist, but in terms of social science, a lay person, I'd say. And her idea was, austerity, it's like more responsible spending, right? Yeah, and I think I thought that was like the most important voice I heard about this discussion, which made me realize a lot of people have this idea of austerity, or at least a good percentage of people have this idea of austerity being about being more responsible.
Yeah.
When in fact, when you read through Clara's book, you realize actually there's more to this. There's actually more of a keeping the status quo. So for, let's say, wealthier elites or the wealthiest parts of society to maintain the system, to maintain their position in society. So it's really interesting. And that's one of the reasons why I really, really, really encourage people to read the book, because you really start to understand the economic system and, you know, why austerity is the thing that it is. It's not this idea of actually responsible spending, but actually this idea of actually oppressing the working class.
But it seems like such an easy sell, right, this idea. And it's sold easily, like, oh no, we have to be responsible, because, you know, even when you're young, maybe you hear your parents, you know, or they tell you, or you know, your teachers, like, you know, in times when you need to when struggling, one has to be a little bit more responsible, spend a little less here, cut this out of your life a little bit, and then later on when times are good, we can live, you know. So it's an easy sell. So you go, yeah, well, of course, that's what you do all the time.
Yeah,
no, it's the fact that it's easily digestible, this idea of responsibility, is obviously part and parcel of the problem. Mm-hmm. Is that a saying? Part and parcel?
Yeah, part and parcel.
Yeah? Okay, good. No.
Yeah. And bringing it full circle back to Andor, because I just cannot stop talking about Andor.
Are we getting paid for this Andor sponsorship?
We better. I think we mentioned it in the interview in terms of austerity is almost a tool of fear. Mm. It is this fear of, oh, wow, the working class or other parts of society are actually going to create a movement or are going to start a movement to change the status quo. So I kind of look at that and that idea again, and just reiterating something that we talked about in the interview, is that it is actually in the hands of society to change that and to actually debate and discuss that. And the better you know what austerity is, the more equipped you are to then tackle it and deal with it. So I always have this idea of quite a lot of hope and optimism in terms of when austerity comes about, actually it's within our hands to combat that. And we can definitely see that with a lot of these strikes that are taking place in the UK. So a lot of unions are getting a lot of support. There's a lot of strikes from all parts of society in the UK. And that's, again, this idea of actually fighting against this form of oppression, at least, and looking
and
for it,
UK, right?
Way forward, absolutely,
globally,
absolutely. So yes, please do grab a hold of the book. We are going to have it within the reading list of the webpage. Great read. It's called "The Capital Order: How Economists Invented Austerity and Paved the Way to Fascism." I think it is readily available across the web, and we're going to provide it in the reading list for the webpage. So, yeah, we can't encourage you guys to read it enough. Oftentimes, academic texts can be a little bit tricky to engage with, but this one, I think, is one of those that is intellectually stimulating, but still is something that you can quite easily read and find quite accessible.
Deepak, do you want to tell the listeners how they can get in contact with us for questions?
Sure. So we are on Twitter. Our Twitter handle is Pod of Wisdom. You can maybe even tweet us and see how we respond. We're more than happy to engage with you guys. We are on Spotify, Apple, Google Podcasts, all those various podcasting platforms. And of course, you can email us on the House of Wisdom podcast at gmail.com. So if you've got any questions, any topics that you'd love us to cover, by all means, send us an email and we'll try our best to cover them. And I will then leave Carl to end the episode.
As usual, thank you for listening. We look forward to joining us in the next episode of the House of Wisdom podcast.